Our second case for this morning is National Shopmen and Others against DISA Industries. And we will hear from Mr. Rifkin.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. My client, the National Shopman Pension Fund, is seeking to collect withdrawal liability in a corrected amount from the appellees here at DISA. The only real issue we see, and we think it's very straightforward, is whether or not DISA waived their right to contest the assessment made by the fund.
So I have a question for you, because I've been looking at this statute, and it's really a very difficult statute. I mean, the district judge looks at it and says 3 years means 3 years, but the statute actually doesn't talk about 3 years. It talks about plan years, and so arguably the company didn't have three plan years. It had two plan years. And it seems to me that puts us between a rock and a hard place, because if you want to go with three, then you would think, well, perhaps doing what the district court did makes some sense, and you just say, well, sometimes Congress approximates. But if you want to really focus on the fact that it says plan years, it's very hard to implement the number three. And so my question for you is whether this might not be an appropriate case for us to seek the views of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Board before we proceed to decide it.
Your Honor, I think the input from the PBGC would be valuable. I also, since the statute is ambiguous, as you state, I think it's important for the court to look at what the PBGC has already said regarding the provision, which is it's supposed to. The purpose of the formula is to create an ongoing stream of contributions that's equal to the highest contribution, really monthly contribution, the employer was making while it participated in the fund.
And beyond that, as I understand it, what this statute is trying to do is come up with, if you will, a hypothetical year that represents the average of these, I mean, in most cases probably it's not hard to do, these three plan years. So it's not trying to say 3 years is something. It's trying to come up with a representative hypothetical 1 year. But what I didn't see in the briefs was any discussion of what one approach versus the other would do to the actuarial soundness of the plan. Of course, the whole point of this withdrawal liability is to make sure that the plan remains actuarially sound.
Well, Your Honor, it would be difficult to tie in exactly withdrawal liability calculation to the actuarial soundness of the plan. If you'll note, in this case, the actual withdrawal liability assessment before the schedule was much higher, and
yeah,
it was limited and reduced.
Do they usually reduce that much? This went from 372 down to 127 over the 20 years?
It's not unusual for there to be a significant reduction. The court should keep in mind that whatever is not paid by this employer goes back in the pool to be paid by the other participating employers. So, in effect, the other participating employers pick up the unfunded liabilities of that employer. So it does have an overall effect. If one employer doesn't pay the withdrawal liability, then all the other employers who participate in the plan are saddled with that withdrawal liability. From a pure equity standpoint, and the purpose of the withdrawal liability provision is to make sure each employer pays their fair share. And getting to the court's point of, do we need the PBGC's input here? I really don't think the court needs to get to this question in the first place, because MEPA could not be clearer that if an employer does not arbitrate a dispute involving the employer's the fund's calculation withdrawal liability, that they've lost their right to challenge that calculation here.
So let me ask you a question, though. Of course, this case is a little odd because we have you know, the initial arbitration, we've got the D.C. things, and then for reasons that I don't fully understand, the company shuts down the arbitration and walks away from it. And in the meantime, there's this revision. I mean, the plan has taken another look at the way all of this was done. So do you envision under the statute that every time the plan revises its overall numbers, as it did here, the whole process starts again and there needs to be a new demand for arbitration by the employer?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the revision occurred before there was any arbitration proceedings. The arbitration had been initiated, but there had been no proceedings in the arbitration. So the company was on notice of the fund's revision, so it had all of its rights preserved with respect to that revision. It was much akin to an amendment to a pleading under Rule 15 of the federal rules.
So you're arguing then that by walking away from the arbitration, they really just forfeited the right to challenge this higher $900-and-some per month assessment?
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't see how they didn't. I mean, they were given all of their procedural rights with respect to the adjustment. For whatever reason, the company made a strategic decision not to continue to arbitrate that issue. The district judge, and what I'll refer to as Shaman 1, the D.C. district judge, has said the matter was arbitrable, and so they were well on notice that the issue was before the arbitrator. And nobody had started briefing. There had been no discovery yet. They would have been entitled to a full plenary hearing before the arbitrator on that issue, and they walked away. And ERISA, the MEPA says the fund's calculation is presumed correct unless found to be unreasonable by an arbitrator, and then it couples that with the provision that the fund can collect on its assessment according to its schedule unless there's been an arbitration initiated.
So the arbitrator might have found, you know, three means three and you lose, but you would have had to live with that.
Well, we could have appealed that to the district court at that point, and that would have been where we would have expected the case to go. The arbitrator would have made a decision on this issue, and whoever lost would have appealed to the district court, but that was cut off when the employer said, we don't want to arbitrate any further. And there was absolutely no reason for the fund to arbitrate, since the fund's calculation was presumed correct, and the fund had a right to collect on it.
So you also think, I mean, because this is a little odd since the arbitration had started, but the principle under the statute of pay now, resolve dispute later should have been followed for this revised amount that you had is in addition. Because, of course, they've been paying the lower amount, right?
Well, we had argued that. That's the interim payment issue that we'd argued to the district court in D.C. and lost. So we said, okay, we lost the interim payment. We can't collect the additional amount until the arbitration's resolved. But once the arbitration was removed by action of the employer, that eliminated the interim payment aspect, and it now became a final payment. And so we sent out the notice, a 60-day letter, saying you've got to cure your default for failure to pay the difference, and they didn't cure. So under the statute, we accelerated. And so I just don't see there was any prejudice to the employer by us by the fund changing their assessment on a procedural basis.
Mm-hmm. How often does it happen that funds go back and revisit payment schedules like this or total amounts due?
Well, I have one client who does this automatically because we get the assessment out quickly, but we don't have the valuation. The fund doesn't have the valuation completed, and the assessment is based on a valuation for the prior year. But as you can imagine, it takes a while for it. You got to get the audit, and then you get the valuation. So we go back and we correct. But we always give the employer the opportunity to challenge that corrected calculation.
And in this case, it was a 5-year delay, right? After the employer withdrew.
It was a 5-year delay before the initial assessment went out. This fund uses what they call the attributable rule method, which is a very complex method to calculate. And for whatever reason, the fund office and the actuary take a long time to get it out.
I have no trouble believing that it's complex, actually, so as this whole area is. So other claims that are floating around here are exhaustion and the question of the scope of the D.C. District Court's opinion. So I don't know if you wanted to address any of that.
Well, I think the district judge got it correct when she said the scope of the D.C. Court's opinion was simply whether or not we had a right, we being the fund, had a right to collect on an interim payment basis. They had argued res judicata be low and lost that.
It was against the backdrop of the then pending arbitration.
Right. And the court said this issue is before the arbitrator. The arbitrator has to decide this before you fund can collect it. And I think that was the limits of the district court's opinion. Anything they said about the 3-year, 2-year was purely dicta, since he said the arbitrator was going to decide the issue. And there is nothing. There is nothing in the district court's decision that somehow shifted the burden from they've argued that somehow the district court's determination saying, well, you've got to arbitrate this, shifted the burden from the employer to the fund to resolve this through arbitration. But that's just that would turn the whole MAPIS construct on its head, and there's nothing in the district court's decision that indicated that. All it said was this is something should be arbitrated since the employer has an arbitration pending. Let the arbitrator decide this. This is not an issue for me. And
you're
I don't think it
rebuttal.
Went any further than that.
You're in your rebuttal, you know.
Okay. I will preserve that.
If you would like to. Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Miosi?
May it please the court. I think there are really two fundamental issues that I would like to emphasize. The first is that Section 4219C, we submit, is clear on its face.
I don't see why it is clear, though, since it uses the term plan year. I don't see how this company had 3 plan years.
I don't think that it really is a correct focus.
It's a word in the statute. You'll agree with me, won't you, that that's what the statute says?
Oh, sure. Sure, it definitely
All
talks
right.
about
and
plan
so
years.
Why did they stick the word plan in front of year? They just would have said 3 years if they hadn't meant us to look at years under which the plan was in effect.
Well, I think fundamentally it's because plans may be operated on a calendar year or fiscal year basis. And I think that's the purpose for the terminology plan year.
So it's a 12-month period is what you're talking
Correct.
About.
It's a 12-month period of time. It's measured at some point in the year. But the purpose is to use a 3-year an average of the annual contribution base units.
If that's what you're going to do, then throwing in a dummy zero yields a completely unrepresentative number. You can prove that mathematically. If you have, 3 years and you divide actual numbers from each of the 3 years, you'll get an average that means something, but it pulls the average down very artificially. And if the statute is trying to come up with essentially a representative year for the actuarial soundness of the plan, and it's, as Mr. Rifkin said, to avoid imposing an undue burden on the other employers in a multi-employer plan, the way that the district court applied this statute gives us a very inequitable result and a very inaccurate result.
Well, I don't think it does.
The federal government at the final analysis is the one holding the bag, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Board, if the plan actually doesn't wind up having enough money.
I don't think that's correct, and I'd refer the court to the Fourth Circuit's opinion in Republic Industries in 1983, where I think they addressed the question that you posed, which is 4219C is not geared purely and exclusively to the interests of the fund, but it answers this. It ensures that employer liability is proportionate to the past annual contributions.
But
it is meant to ameliorate the substantial harsh result particularly for a for an employer such as DISA Industries, which was in only for 2 years.
Has its issues, but the thing is, DISA never had a year in which this phony average number was used. They had 1 year where maybe it was a lower number of employees, and another year in which it was a higher number. If they'd only been in the plan 1 year, then they would have been paying contributions on only one-third the number of employees that they had. And that seems like a perverse result. What do you think of my thought that maybe we should ask the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation what it thinks about this statute?
Our view, Your Honor, is that it wouldn't be necessary. Again, our argument. I hear
but
what you're saying.
We could do it if we wanted to.
Certainly can. You most certainly can. It's our view that that would not be necessary. I'm not saying it's inappropriate, obviously, but I don't believe it's necessary given the language in the statute. And the fact is, even if you're
not troubled by the thought that if you'd been in the plan for 1 year, you would have sort of gotten the windfall of paying withdrawal liability based on only one-third of your employees.
But there's no other
way you could do that.
But I think that misses the point that for an employer.
That is, you agree that that's the effect. Let's just start with
adding
effect.
Zero in?
If you had been in the plan 1 year and we read the statute your way to have a zero for year one, a zero for year two, and let's just say, to keep the numbers easy, 300 employees for year three, then you'd have a total of 300 employees for 3 years divided by 3 years, which would be 100 people that you would be then required to pay withdrawal liability on. And yet never was there a time that you had 100 employees. It would be a third of your employees.
But the effect of that, my comment a moment ago, the effect of that is the benefits that the employees can expect from the fund for having participated for only 1 year are smaller.
Because these things are portable. For all we know, some of those people have worked at other companies. The point is that the fund has these, of the 300 people, perhaps, 250 have vested in the fund. I guess you don't worry about the other. I don't know what you do with the other people who have invested, but let's assume all of them have vested. I don't see why the way withdrawal liability works, your company is responsible for every year of work those people did. It's just that you're looking for one representative year, and the question is 300 a representative number or is 100 a representative number?
But even for an employer that contributed, use an example of a hypothetical of 10 years, if you look at the fluctuation of contribution-based units, whether it's hours or employees, it doesn't really matter. You're only looking to approximate.
Sure, and if you have a 10-year employer and, maybe 1 year business was great and they had 500 people and another year business was terrible and they only had 150 people and another year maybe it was somewhere in the middle, you'd wind up with an average number so that they're not paying at the highest level, that would be unfair, nor are they paying at the lowest level. But under your system, there's a way of automatically reducing the contribution units, if you will, the employees or the hours or whatever they may be.
Well, with all due respect, I think we're just simply reading the statute. And when the statute instructs that a three-year average is to be the appropriate number, that's all we are standing upon.
And I guess your reading of the statute has the virtue of allowing it to be applied where we ignore the notion of a plan year that I'm talking about and we just say three is three. The disadvantage of your reading of the statute is it ignores the word plan in front of the word year, and it leads to a result that's really in tremendous tension with the purpose of the MPPAA.
I don't believe that we're contending that the modifier plan year, we're not ignoring that.
No, you're not arguing. That's my argument.
Oh, no, I'm suggesting that we aren't arguing that. And it doesn't matter when in the year you measure. There's going to be a three-year period, which is established by the plan. Three consecutive years.
What if Congress just failed to think that maybe some companies would only be in the plan for a year? So the statute just doesn't address that point. What do we do about that?
I suppose it's for Congress to address would be my answer. Given the language in the statute, a three-year average. I guess I can't. I don't mean to belabor the point, but a three-year average is straightforward. There are only two courts who've looked at this provision. One is Judge Lamberth in the District Court in D.C., and of course Judge Kendall.
We respect both of them. Could you tell me, just to change subjects for a minute, why you withdrew from the arbitration in D.C.? You could have had all of this long since done if you had stayed in the arbitration in D.C. and proceeded through the process that was already underway.
I appreciate, because I did want to get to that question when you raised it earlier on the appellant's argument. One, the court, Judge Lamberth, had issued his opinion, and he construed 4219C. Now, I don't believe, just my view, and I think the language of the court's opinion, of Judge Lamberth's opinion, indicated he had to construe 4219. So I don't think it was dicta. But we had an order from the court. It became a final order in about November 18th, 2008.
But you were putting all your eggs in that basket, really, because there was never any appeal of Judge Lamberth's order, so it's non-precedential. You thought maybe resolved your case, but maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Judge Kendall didn't think it did, actually.
Well, Judge Wood, it was not precedential. I completely agree. But it was binding on these two parties because it was a final order.
Until there was an appeal to the D.C. Circuit.
Correct. And that time period passed November 18, 2008. Number two, the statute only gives the fund, in effect, one shot at this.
I think it was a final order, though. I mean, because the truth is what Judge Lamberth is saying is that there's an arbitration pending, and so certain issues need to go to the arbitrator. I'm not sure this court would regard that as something that satisfies 1291.
Well, we aren't obligated to proceed with the arbitration. We have the opportunity.
You would agree with me. It's probably not a final order, so it would have been a fruitless effort to try to get the D.C. Circuit to look at what Judge Lamberth said.
I don't agree with that. I don't agree.
When you say arbitration is pending, when a court denies arbitration, then there's in the statute the ability to take an interlocutory order to the courts of appeals. But when a court defers to arbitration, there usually is not an appeal.
But to answer your question, it gets back to our contention that Judge Lamberth did interpret 4219C.
In the context, I'm thinking of this now as an appellate judge, in the context of an order that says there's an ongoing arbitration, I think if I saw that on a notice of appeal, I would think this is non-final. Arbitration is pending. It's not the time to come to the Court of Appeals.
And I would emphasize that the court's interpretation of 4219 was binding on the parties, and it would be binding on
arbitration. That's just one interlocutory order. That happens all the time. District courts issue orders. They're binding on the parties before them unless or until they're changed. Absolutely. You know, parties don't go around second-guessing court orders.
To complete the issues, to answer to your question, why we didn't proceed with the arbitration, A, we had Judge Lamberth's opinion. B, we were satisfied that with the initial demand and assessment the fund made, we had been making the monthly installments and continue to make them from the day they were asserted. So we had no issue. We didn't anticipate we were going to convince an arbitrator that the assessment was subject to any change. But what's important here, and the point that I'd like to leave the court with, is Section 4221A1 imposes on both parties the duty to arbitrate. It is not just the employer.
I'm not sure it's a duty. I mean, both parties can ask for arbitration.
Correct that statement. Obviously, it's not a duty. But it is the obligation of either party who has a problem with the assessment to proceed to an arbitration. We gave notice to the fund that we were going to withdraw our demand for arbitration, and the fund opted not to pursue its own claim. And they had the right and, I believe, obligation under 4221A1. And I think Judge Kendall properly...
I thought you were conceding that their assessment was correct. I mean, apparently that's what they thought.
We were indeed conceding that the initial assessment was correct.
Their revised assessment, the $987 a month assessment. Maybe they thought you were conceding that, because that was already on the table by the time you withdrew.
No, it was not, because the court indicated it was inappropriate.
It had happened, right? I mean, let's not be too picky. It had happened, and whether it was one of the things within the terms of reference of the arbitration order perhaps is a different issue, but it, everyone knew that that was what the fund now thought you owed.
But the fund didn't issue the new demand until after we had withdrawn from the arbitration and given them notice that we were going to do so, and they did not object. Now, I think Judge Kendall properly identifies that for her to hold that DISA somehow failed to exhaust its administrative remedies and not hold that that the Shopman's Fund failed to exhaust its administrative remedies would be incorrect and would be in conflict with 4221A1. Unless there are questions, thank you. We ask that the district court's order be affirmed.
Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Rifkin?
I just wanted to correct a misstatement made at the end there where he said that the fund's revision did not come out till after the arbitration had been dismissed. Clearly that wasn't the case, since that was what Judge Slammer was looking at was our adjustment, and he was the one who said it should be arbitrated.
I was going to ask you about that. You issued the revised assessment after the arbitration had begun, but before the D.C. Circuit, before the District Court, Judge Lamberth. When you filed the suit after they refused, right?
After they refused to pay on the adjusted amount.
So the District Court in D.C. doesn't even have a case until you've asked them to pay the higher amount and they've said no.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then we revised the assessment almost shortly after they initiated arbitration. And as I said earlier, there had been no proceedings in the arbitration at that point other than the letter and the agreement on an arbitrator.
Did you ever somehow communicate to the arbitrator that the scope of the arbitration had broadened?
Yes, Your Honor. The arbitrator was well aware of that. In fact, we had settlement negotiations before the arbitrator based on that revised assessment, and were unable to settle at that point. So the arbitrator was well aware of it, and the arbitration would have gone forward on that basis had DISA not withdrawn its arbitration demand and dismissed the arbitration.
How did the arbitrator become aware of it?
The parties amended their the notice of the revised assessment was provided to the arbitrator by the fund.
So your answer to Judge Wood's initial question was, yes, you provided it with a written notice.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's in the record.
Yes. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. And just one other point, as you correctly note, the MEPA, when it deals with arbitration and the funds up and the party's right to arbitrate, the wording in the provision is permissive. It uses the word that either party may request arbitration. There certainly are circumstances where a fund may want the input of a MEPA arbitrator on an issue. The American Arbitration Association has a specific panel of arbitrators who have expertise in this area, and so that explains why the May language is in there, and it refers to a fund as well. But there's certainly, as I mentioned earlier, there are two provisions in the MEPA which make it clear that one, the funds calculation is presumed correct unless it is found to be unreasonable by an arbitrator, and two, the fund can collect on that assessment unless arbitration is initiated. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel.